Okay.
Today is November 19th, 2013. My name is Evan Falkenbury with the Southern Oral History Program, and today I'm interviewing Julian Bond here at the Love House in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. So, Mr. Bond, the first question I have, I was reading over a prior SOHP interview with yourself, and you talked about how you went to a Quaker prep school and how pacifism influenced your early activism, but then that you had moved away from pacifism in a sense. So I'm wondering now if you could discuss where you are now with your belief in pacifism.
Well, I think I was always a situational believer in nonviolence. That is to say, while colleagues like John Lewis became convinced to it as a way of life, it never seemed a way of life to me. It was a tactic, a technique, and that when on the picket line or in the protest march, one ought to practice nonviolence, but in all other times you do as you like, and I tend to do as I like. So I can't say I was nonviolent in everything I did. In fact, I know I was not, but I believed it a tremendously useful technique, and I'm surprised really that it's not more often used today.
Why do you think it's not used more often today?
I think people can't figure out, how can I use this technique to get this aim? How can I use this process to win a strike or to promote some social gain? And if I think they just applied themselves a little more, they could do it and you'd see more people doing it, but unfortunately you don't see more people using it.
Right. Do you think that people have, with the memory of the civil rights movement and the pacifist activism, do you think it's less people not knowing their past, or in a sense people are disconnected from how movements functioned in the past?
Yeah, yes and no. I think that's true of some people.
Right.
But I think it's also that you live in an X city or town and you see a problem and you wonder, how can I approach this problem? How can I solve this problem? Black people not hired at this place, some other problem confronting us here. And we don't think immediately about using nonviolent direct action. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure why that is, because it seems so simple to me and seems so successful.
Right.
I recently was arrested outside the White House protesting the big thing Obama's probably going to okay. The pipeline.
The Keystone.
The Keystone, yeah, thank you.
Right.
Keystone Pipeline. And it was essentially an exercise in nonviolence. Mm-hmm. 100 people, most of them environmentalists, locked themselves to the White House gates, and police asked to leave and got arrested and were taken off to jail.
Right.
And it created a tremendous media flow in D.C., brought a lot of attention to it, and I thought, you know, this is just what movements like this need to be doing, and why aren't more of them doing it? And more of them are doing it. It's not like nobody's doing it. John Lewis mentioned last night that he had been arrested for his 42nd time at the White House, or rather, not at the White House, in Washington, in some protest protesting the immigration laws. So other people do use it, but people don't use it as often as they might. Mm-hmm.
I understand that protest outside of the White House, that was organized through the Sierra Club?
Yes, that was the first time.
Right.
Practicing civil disobedience.
Yeah, they don't have a history of that kind of disobedience, but now maybe they're adopting those tactics.
Yeah.
Great. So I'm wondering if we can go back now into the 1960s and thinking about your earliest activism. So can you tell me about how you became the communications director for SNCC?
I went to the Raleigh conference where the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was founded. And so I was present at the creation and had already played a bit of a role as a publicist for the local Atlanta sit-in movement. And so it just naturally carried over to the formation of SNCC that I would do the same for this larger organization. And I was interested in media, interested in journalism, badly wanted to be engaged in this, and I think I just slid into it, and there I was. And I can remember the telephone number of the Associated Press in Atlanta. If you called it right now, I believe it's 404-522-8961 or 71. One of the two of those.
Maybe we'll test it later.
I tested in my class, and they always answer. Some students all have cell phones, you know. Right. They call up, and somebody answers Associated Press.
So the larger point of that story, I imagine, is that you were constantly
all the time
putting out information.
You know, it's curious. I can't remember the phone number of the United Press. Of course, I never called them as often as the Associated Press, but I always called the Associated Press because if you got on the Associated Press wire, your story went everywhere. And that was the dream, to get it to go everywhere. And if you couldn't get on the wire, you could always call the York Daily News. The editor of the York Daily News was kind of leftish guy. I can't think of his name. Mm-hmm. But you call him, and he'd call the Associated Press and say, send me a story about what happened in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. And bam, they'd send it. So it'd go to every paper between Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and York, Pennsylvania, and all stations in between, and the story just carried on.
Wow. So did you find your dealings with big media and local media as the communications director, what were some of your relationships like with some of these media folks?
Most of the relationships were with the Atlanta newspapers, the Atlanta Constitution, the Atlanta Journal, two Cox-owned newspapers, owned by the Cox Company, the Atlanta Daily World, which is the daily black newspaper, mm-hmm. Initially, two black newspapers, weekly newspapers, the Atlanta Inquirer and the Atlanta, can't remember the name of the other one, but these two non-daily newspapers. And we wanted to get some stories in them because our immediate constituency was Atlanta, and we wanted them, people in Atlanta, to read about what we're doing. But also, you wanted to be in the Journal and the Constitution because the AP would pick up these stories and send them across the nation. So it was dealing with them. Then Atlanta was also the headquarters of the Newsweek, of Time Magazine. They had bureaus there, mm-hmm. and we wanted to talk to them, and I got to know the people in those bureaus. It's funny, last night I saw Arlie Shart, who was a Time Magazine guy, covered the movement for Time Magazine. It was great to see him. And there's a little colony of these people who live in D.C., and every now and then you run into them.
Right. So did you find that people at Newsweek and elsewhere, why do you think they were so interested in SNCC in particular?
I think because we were open in ways that the others weren't. I think some of the others, civil rights organizations, had this feeling toward the press, a little, who are these people? Do they mean us harm? Or mm-hmm. do they want to report bad things about us? Something. We just thought they want to report the story. And if we give them the story, they'll report the story. And if we tell them the truth, and they find out we're always truthful, we're not telling lies, we're not stretching things, we're telling you what happened, who did it, where it happened, where, when, how, and where, mm-hmm. They would put it on their wires or put it in their papers.
Right. So as communications director, I imagine you weren't only communicating with news outlets, but perhaps also with other civil rights organizations. Can you talk about how you your relationship during your time with SNCC, with the NAACP, with the SCLC, which is of course related to SNCC, but those relationships?
Well, really, I didn't have much relationship with these other organizations. The people working for SNCC in the field did. And typically with the NAACP, because the NAACP had people in all of these towns and cities where we were working. So typically the SNCC person and the NAACP person would be in close contact with each other. But I seldom had much to do with them at all. Mm-hmm. Just the nature of what I did and what they were doing, I didn't dislike them mm-hmm. or abhor them or stay away from them, but I didn't have much contact with them at all.
Sure. Well, that's interesting. So it makes it seem as though, you know, SNCC was very focused on SNCC activities, mm-hmm. which I think in some tellings, you know, it makes it seem like everybody was working together, which I think is largely true.
Excuse me.
Sure.
I think they did work together. But we also, you know, were watchful that this group didn't take credit for what that group had done.
Sure.
And with SCLC, it wasn't just that they were taking credit for what SNCC did, is that the media often gave them credit for what we were doing. And so part of my job was saying, no, we did that. They didn't do that, we did that.
Oh,
and here's the truth, and you need to tell who really did this thing?
What was a big contentious spot, the Albany movement with who?
Yes, because here's the NAACP, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, mm-hmm. the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, all three organizations working in the same city, and sometimes working at odds, sometimes working together cooperatively, doing the same thing together, but sometimes working at odds with each other.
Right.
So, some saying, let's do this, and others saying, no, let's do that.
Right.
So my job was to make sure the media covering this knew who did what, why, and why they did it, and why they should get credit for doing it, because credit meant money.
Right.
Credit meant attention. Credit meant credit, that we were getting known as the group that did X, Y, Z, and boy, look at that, that was great.
Right. And did you find that media folks, when you tried to set the story straight, were they sometimes resistant, or did they take you at your word?
I think over time they got to take us at our word, mm-hmm. because we tried to make sure, I hate to say it, my word was my bond. We got to try every time we said something, it was true. We didn't want to say, take credit for something we had done, we had not done. We didn't want to never stretch the truth. We wanted to make sure what we were saying was true.
Right.
And as they got to see that, and as they got to believe that, then our credit just went up.
Sure. Were there ways that you felt the media misrepresented what you were doing in SNCC?
Yes and no. Not misrepresented as much as just misperceived what we'd done, or again, gave credit to somebody else for doing what we had done, which is just awfully frustrating. Because,
sure.
you know, Dr. King was such a powerful figure, such a potent figure, such a big figure. Mm-hmm. It's so easy to say, King had this protest thing in Albany, Georgia today. And sometimes it was not King, it was us. Or sometimes it was somebody at NAACP. But whoever it was, we wanted to make sure the story was told correctly,
right.
and we got the credit.
Since the 1960s, what's your feeling on how the media has shaped the history of the civil rights movement? Do you think that it's been fair or nuanced enough? Or that's a broad question.
It is a big, broad question. I was just thinking, you know, the headquarters of the NAACP today is in Baltimore, Maryland. That's where our national office is.
Mm-hmm.
And there used to be a man working for the Baltimore Sun who just knew the NAACP up and down,
mm-hmm.
knew the people who worked there, knew their history, knew everything about them. And while he was at the Sun, I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, while he was at the Sun, we could be sure that if the NAACP did something good, or if something bad happened at the NAACP, and bad things do happen, that he would report it, bam, 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 and you knew it was in good hands. And he's left the Sun many years ago, or 10 years ago. He's going off to something else. You know how newspapers are now.
Right.
And the people who are there now have no idea of the NAACP's history.
Mm-hmm.
So when the NAACP comes into the news, they really aren't sure how to handle this. And if they handle it at all, they handle it clumsily. They don't understand the difference between the NAACP and this organization. They don't understand the history. They don't understand most of the things you need to understand if you're going to write about it intelligently.
Mm-hmm.
So when future historians are looking back at the Baltimore Sun, at the account of some XYZ thing that happened in Baltimore with the NAACP, I'm afraid they're not going to get a true picture.
So it was more about personal relationships.
Yes, and the skill that this man employed and his ability to just know everything there was to know about the NAACP, because that was his job.
Right.
I think what happens today is they have some young guy or young woman who's doing this, and he or she covers everything, and you can't cover everything anyway.
And at the time, I suppose there were reporters specifically on what's happening in Mississippi in 1963.
Right, or you had, and you've seen the book, The Race Beat, about the reporters who covered the civil rights movement. It's a great big thick book. It's a wonderful book because it tells the stories of these people, most of them white, working for the big mainline papers, the New York Times, the mm-hmm. Washington Post, and so on.
Right.
And for the wire services and for the news magazines. And some black working for the black press and so on. And this was sort of a golden age of civil rights journalism, when these real powerful figures like Arlie Sharpe, like Jack Nelson, covered the civil rights movement. When they were out there, you knew you were in good hands because they were serious about what they did.
Right, right. Let me ask about transitioning slightly away. What was your involvement with, and I confess I don't know much about these, but I'm asking for a friend who's working on the media. What was your involvement with the founding of the Institute for Southern Studies and with Southern Exposure?
You know, I have a terrible memory, and I'm lucky to know that it's not because of any condition that's overtaken me. It's been true for most of my adult life.
I see.
So I don't remember the founding of the Institute for Southern Studies, except I had something to do with it.
Okay.
I was part of the founding of it. But you have to ask Bob Hall about these things. He knows these things.
Oh,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. So I don't know, but I know I played a role in the founding of the Institute for Southern Studies, and I think my father did too. But ask Bob Hall.
Okay.
He'll know.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask about, that's perfectly fine. Well, let me ask about just this idea of the central, I guess, you know, crux of part of the movement in the 60s was, you know, fighting for voting rights and for rights of citizenship. So as you were a politician, as you were a SNCC activist, you certainly felt that voting was an important civil right.
Yeah.
So why do you think voting was the central, or one of the central concerns of the civil rights movement?
Because it just seemed obvious to us that if you could register this mass of black people, who were generally speaking not registered at all, and had no influence in the politics of their states, of their cities, of their counties, had nothing to say about this. If you got them registered to vote, you'd create a mighty, mighty force that could be only be a force for good. And so all of us, the NAACP from its very beginnings, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, all these organizations favored on the right to vote. Mm-hmm. That was our main preoccupation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So once the Voting Rights Act in 1965 was passed Congress, how do you think that changed the character of the movement once voting became a bit, you know, more guarded in the South?
It was an incredible leap forward. It meant that people who were powerless suddenly had power and had something to say about what was happening in their communities. It meant they could be office holders, they could be state representatives, they could be state senators, they could be county commissioners, they could be city council members, they could be sheriffs, they could be all those things, which they could never dream of doing before. And once in those jobs, they could exercise power and they could say, we're going to do this and we're going to do this. And I don't care what the white people have to say about it, we're going to do it anyway. And it was just an enormous jump forward. Now, as we know, these right to vote is under attack, particularly in the old Confederate states, the traitor states, are doing everything they can to weaken it. But I think we'll overcome that too, sooner or later.
I certainly want to ask about, you know, the state of things right now with voter laws. But before I get there, I want to ask a few other questions from earlier on. About the Voter Education Project. Mm-hmm. Can you discuss, maybe first with SNCC, what your involvement was with the Voter Education Project?
Well, not much with the foundation of the Voter Education Project. It came out of the coming together of some foundations interested in registering black voters, mm-hmm. and putting together this organization called the Voter Education Project, this nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that would spend money in the South to register voters. And they began to give money to these civil rights organizations, mm-hmm. less money, I will say, to the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee than they did the others, even though we registered more people, more voters than the others did. This is so frustrating. Anyway. And John Lewis, my friend of many years standing, became the director, and he and I would take these trips to Mississippi primarily, but also Alabama and Louisiana and Arkansas, but Mississippi primarily, traveling from town to town to town to town, going to rallies in churches or other community halls or something, talking to people about registering to vote. And this was just a wonderful time for us because we'd drive from here to there, get out of our cars, crowd waiting for us, go in there and speak. And, you know, I remember going to Belzoni, Mississippi, and I knew Belzoni is a place where black people have been killed for trying to vote. And John and I are speaking, the place is crowded, hundreds of people in there, people standing up all over. And all of a sudden, while I'm speaking, this white man comes in the door, and I think, oh my God, this guy's gonna kill me. And he made his way through the crowd, pushed his way, I said, what the hell is going to happen here? He says, welcome, I'm the mayor of Belzoni. I thought, oh my God, here's the mayor of Belzoni, Mississippi, saying welcome to me. How could this ever happen? It happened because he knows these people are going to be his voters in a year or two, and he's got to be, pay attention to them. Mm-hmm. But I was scared to death.
Wow. So you went on multiple trips throughout
many,
the
many
South.
Many trips.
The spirit of these trips, so you're saying that it was, you know, kind of more, the voter, this was in the early 70s, I'm assuming. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, certainly some time had passed since the Voting Rights Act. So the spirit of these trips was usually more lighthearted or
yes,
more
very much so, very
educational.
Much so. John and myself and this guy who worked for the VEP, Voter Education Project, Archie Allen, the three, and sometimes Tom Houck, who also worked for the Voter Education Project, it would usually always be the four of us. Occasionally it was my brother-in-law, his name is Claude Clopton, my former wife's brother. He also worked for the BEP. So it'd be four or five of us. And we'd travel with one or two cars from town to town to town to town. And previously, these rallies would have been set up in advance. So when we got to a place, there was a crowd waiting for us. And then we'd spend the night someplace. And I'll tell you a story. There was a woman traveling with us from one of the big foundations. I won't tell you the name of the foundation. And we found out, or I found out, that she had a fascination with fire engines. And so in order to make her have the best time she had, she could possibly have, I got us to drive past every little fire station in Mississippi and say, oh, there's a fire engine over there, look at that. I think it made a big difference. And we got more money from her than we would have ordinarily.
So philanthropies would send folks down to...
Oh, yes. Well, she came along the trip. Her foundation had given lots of money to the Voter Education Project, mm-hmm. and therefore to SNCC, and she was there to see how the money was being spent.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was a wise strategy then to do what she wanted.
I was proud of myself. Well, there's a fire engine there.
That was a smart strategy. So these trips that you and John Lewis and others took, what do you think was the lasting impact of these kinds of trips in the early 70s in communities that had only recently been able to vote, you know, unencumbered?
Some of these communities had never seen a state senator. I was a state senator or a state representative then.
Right.
John Lewis had not reached his celebrity then, but he was well known. He had spoken at the March on Washington. People remembered him from that.
Yes.
So when he and I appeared, people were glad to see us, happy to see us, wanted to touch us, wanted to get our autographs. I'd never had anybody ask me for an autograph before. And so it was just a wonderful feeling, and people were happy to see you and listen to what you had to say, and you got the feeling they would do something about it. So it was just a good, good thing all around.
Right. Before, I suppose, John Lewis became the VEP director, what was your relationship like, or what was your opinion of the VEP's work under Wiley Branton and Vernon Jordan later?
It was good under both of those, but I didn't have as much to do with it under these two guys. Mm-hmm. I knew them both, knew them well, mm-hmm. liked them, admired them, and right. thought their work was good work, but I didn't have any real relationship with the organization then until John took it over.
Right.
And then he and I took it off.
Right. In what ways did you think that yours and John Lewis's work with SNCC translate into VEP into the 1970s?
I think, unlike the NAACP for which Vernon Jordan had worked,
right.
and the NAACP for which Wiley Branton was a lawyer, mm-hmm. We had more of a connection with grassroots people and more of thinking that you had to connect with grassroots people. Now, the NAACP is a grassroots organization, mm-hmm. but I think we really believe that. And we really said, if we're going to get something done, we got to get to the people in these small towns, mm-hmm. in these little country places. We got to talk to them, engage them somehow or the other. Mm-hmm. So we brought a higher level of engagement to our work, I think, than they had done. Not because they were bad people, not at all, but we were better people.
So, last question about the VEP. I saw that you wrote a good bit of material for them about educating about the vote and mm-hmm. about the process of politics and this sort of thing, and that you also served on their board of directors.
Yeah.
Can you talk about writing for them and then serving on their board?
Yeah, I don't remember what I wrote. I don't remember being on the board either. But, you know, when John took it over, I became much more engaged in it than I had been before.
Sure.
I had known Vernon Jordan for a long time. I got to know Wiley Brand when he became head of the VEP, but John and I were close friends, close friends.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, not that I want to skip ahead a little bit and talk about after your political career out of Georgia and when you became a professor of the movement, a teacher of the movement. So, how did you bridge your activism with scholarship for teaching about the movement?
Well, I had run for Congress. John Lewis ran against me.
Right.
He won.
Right.
I lost. But like most people do, I went to Washington anyway. And I found myself in Washington. I had to give up my state Senate seat to run for Congress. So I was unemployed, nothing to do, no money coming in. I was making a couple of speeches. And had also become the host of a TV show called America's Black Forum. America's Black Forum, something I can't remember what the announcer would always say every day. Anyway, as a talk show, and I was the host. And a constant guest was the president of American University, because he was a tremendously articulate man, a brilliant man. He could talk on any subject, and when we needed a guest, we'd get him. And one day he asked me, he said, "What do you do besides this?" I said, "Nothing really." I said, "I make speeches when I can." He said, "Would you like to speak at American University?" I said, "Sure." And so he hired me to speak at American University, and I teach there now, today. Mm-hmm. Then I met a young woman, Patricia Sullivan, an academic, yes. And she asked me if I'd like to teach at University of Virginia. I said, "Sure." So I taught at American University on Mondays, and I taught at Virginia on Tuesdays. And then I met someone who said, "Would you like to teach at Harvard?" And I said, "Yes," and I taught at Harvard, and later came back. I taught for one semester at Harvard, mm-hmm. came back later for another semester at Harvard. Met someone who said, "Would you like to teach at Williams?" I said, "Yes." I taught at Williams. Met someone who said, "Would you like to speak at the University of Pennsylvania?" I said, "Sure." "Would you speak at night, teach at night?" I said, "Yes." Said, "Would you like to teach at Drexel in the afternoon?" "Yes." So I taught at Drexel in the afternoon and Penn at night. So I taught at many of these schools, a sort of half syllabus will travel. And then I found myself pretty steadily at the University of Virginia, mm-hmm. just retired last year. Right. This year, May of this year, but still at American University. And I'd never done this before. I knew that people, you know, I came from an academic family background. My father was a college president.
Yes.
And had a PhD from Chicago. And I knew that almost everybody in my departments also had a PhD degree, and I had a bachelor's degree, and barely had that. So I thought I had to know more than they did. So I just had a lot of books already about the civil rights movement. So I just read and read and read and read and took notes. I had this enormous shoebox about this long, full of 3x5 cards with a history of the civil rights movement like that. And I'd go into class and I'd start at this end, pick up this thing, and I'd lecture and lecture and lecture and lecture. Over time, I got better at it and a little better, more organized by it. And so I made up a narrative, or I created a narrative of the civil rights movement, and I'd always wanted, I think because of my SNCC background, wanted to talk about the ordinary people, the regular people. I knew Dr. King was a lead figure in the civil rights history, but he's not the only figure. And if you concentrate on him alone, you're missing a whole list of people, mm-hmm. group of people who need their names called, need their behavior put out in front of students. Young people need to know that people like themselves did this. It wasn't always these magical figures like Dr. King. And so that's the way I developed my lectures, and that's the way I teach my lectures now.
Mm-hmm. So what's it like teaching young people about the civil rights movement who didn't grow up in it in the same way that you did?
It is interesting in this sense that they're eager to find out something about it. All these classes I teach are voluntary classes. These are not required classes. Mm-hmm. These students don't have to be there. They're there because they want to be there. I met a student of mine in the airport today when we landed in Raleigh today, a young man I had taught at the University of Virginia, who now works, he told me who he works for now, he's a consultant for some big company. But I met him today and he told me how much he enjoyed the classes he had had under me, which of course is always what the teacher wants to hear.
Of course.
And I run into my students all the time who are doing wonderful things all over the country. And I take credit for everything they're doing now. I've never met one who's a thief or a crook, or I don't think.
That's good.
But it it's just a wonderful thing to be in this room full of these young people and to open their eyes to something they know a little bit about. First day of class, I always ask them what they do know. And I'll tell you what they know. There used to be segregation. Mm-hmm. Martin Luther King came along. He marched, he protested, he was killed, and the segregation went away. And that's the story. And that is the story. But the story is much bigger than that. It's much more complex than that. Right. Many more people involved in it than him. Right. So I want them to get the whole of the story and understand all of it if they can. And I think at the end of the semester, I think they do.
So it sounds like teaching has been a fulfilling
part
of your life.
Very much so, yeah. I'm teaching a course right now at American University called Oral Histories of the Civil Rights Movement. And my students have to find people who were involved in the 1960s Civil Rights Movement. They have to interview that person. Then they have to construct an oral biography of that person told in that person's words. And they begin the class by saying, oh, we can't find anybody like that. Or else they say, we want to interview John Lewis. And I say, no, you can't interview John Lewis. He's been interviewed. I have a list here of people you can't interview, and he's one of them. So they say, we can't find anybody. I said, there are people on this campus who fit this description. There are people teaching here who fit in this. So eventually they do find people, and they come away with these wonderful, wonderful stories of people who played either big or relatively small roles in the movement, but they're just wonderful, wonderful stories.
That's incredible to use oral history in that regard. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. Well, let me ask now about, could you tell about how you became nominated for and then accepted the NAACP chairmanship in 1999, I believe?
Well, Merle Evers Williams had been the chairman of the NAACP. The previous NAACP chairman before her had been involved in a minor scandal, but in the NAACP it was big. He had taken some NAACP money for his own use, and it was a small amount of money, but he shouldn't have done it in the first place, and it was just awful. And there was a movement to unseat him. And the NAACP is loyal to its leadership. And if you've been in the leadership, people will say, well, let's keep him or her for another year, another time. Anyway, he lost by one vote. Merle Evers won and succeeded him. And she served for two terms, and she almost broke her neck, traveling around the country, raising money, doing all the things that a vibrant chairman has to do to keep the organization going. Because we were in bad shape, bad financial shape, because the publicity about this previous chairman was so negative, the organization began to falter and fall apart, and she brought it back to life. And then she decided she couldn't run again, that she was too beaten down to run again. And a group of the board members asked me if I would run to succeed her. And after some convincing, I decided to do it, and I won, and I served for the next 11 years. Mm-hmm. The chairman of the NAACP had one-year terms, and I served 11 terms.
Right. So how, as the chair, how did you want to continue the NAACP's work, and how also did you want to change the organization?
I didn't want to change it much because I thought it was doing pretty well. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do certain things. One of the things I did was I raised the amount of money it cost to be a member of the NAACP. I don't remember what the figure was, but some place around $10. Well, you know, the Ku Klux Klan charged more than that. And that's the argument I used to raise the money for the NAACP. I think it's $30 now to be a member of the NAACP. But we don't make most of our money from dues anyway. Mm-hmm. I wanted to widen our circle of donors, the people who gave us money, and not just the regular people, the labor unions, the liberal foundations, those kinds of people. I wanted to come to wealthy Americans who had money and were liberal and wanted to support civil rights, and I began to look for those people. And my most successful gift was from a man whom I met through his lawyer. And I wrote a proposal for $100,000 from this guy and sent it to his lawyer, and his lawyer said, that's not enough. He said, write another. So I wrote another proposal with no money in it, just we need more money than this. He gave me $25 million, biggest contribution we have ever had.
Wow.
And it was to raise money to register black voters in 2000. And the requirement was the money had to be spent between June and November, or to spend $25 million between June and November. And I thought, how can I spend this money? Who can do this for me? I can't do it. And so I went to a remarkable woman named Heather Booth, who was just a wonderful organizer. And it was hard to get her because this was in the middle of the presidential campaign and all the political people had jobs. They're working for the presidential, Democratic presidential candidate, or people running for the U.S. House, U.S. Senate, people working in politics. Well, she put together a staff, and between June and November, she spent every penny of that money and spent it well, and we registered hundreds of thousands of voters.
Wow.
So you could really see the impact
of that. And you could see it right there at the end of the thing because, you know, this money wasn't spread out.
Right.
From June to November.
Very quickly in the 2000 elections.
Yes. And it paid off, too.
Right. So what do you think are the ongoing struggles with the NAACP right now? Or what challenges does the NAACP continue?
The NAACP has just lost its CEO. A young man named Benjamin Jellis, a Rhodes Scholar, a wonderful guy, one of the best CEOs we've ever had. He wore himself out working for the NAACP. He traveled almost half of the year. He was on the road, traveling, speaking to branches, speaking to conventions, talking to donors, talking to our partners, just wore himself out. And he has two young children, and his wife works at teaches at American University at the law school. And so he left us. We couldn't make him stay. We wanted to, but you know, you can't. You can only ask people for so much.
Sure.
So he has left us. We have an interim CEO right now, and we're beginning the process of putting together a search committee to find somebody else. It'll be hard to find somebody who can take Ben Jellis' place, but we found him, and I think we can find somebody like him.
Right.
And so we'll see.
Right.
We've been done pretty well with our CEOs. You know, we've had some ups and downs, but mostly they've been good people, and they've done their job.
That's great. So let me ask about, because you mentioned the Keystone Pipeline earlier in your protest regarding that. So how has your conception of civil rights broadened to include other issues?
Well, it's not just my conception. I think it's the conception of what civil rights are.
Right.
I'm happy to have been in the NAACP when we supported same-sex marriage. And I'll tell you something sad. I've always believed in same-sex marriage. But when I was chairman for 11 years, I never wanted to bring it up. I thought we'd vote no. And I'd rather we had no position than have the wrong position, because I was afraid to bring this issue up.
Mm-hmm.
But after I'd left the chairmanship, I was still on the board. I'm still on the board now. Mm-hmm. I was sitting at a board meeting, and this guy right here gets up and makes a motion to say, okay, we support same-sex marriage. And I thought to myself, don't bring it up to myself. I said, they'll vote no. And we have 64 people on the board of directors. Two were absent, but the vote on this was 60-2. And I said, I've been underestimating my colleagues on the board. I didn't realize that they were at least as far advanced on this issue as I was, and probably some of them more so. So I was happy to be on the board when that happened. I was happy to have brought Ben Jellis to the NAACP. I hired him, or he became CEO under my watch, and he took us into the internet world much further than we had been. We had, you know, had email and all that stuff, but he took us way into this world in ways of raising money and contacting people and building support that we never would have done without him. And I was happy to be there when this happened. He tightened our relationships with other organizations, Hispanic organizations, environmental organizations. We are in coalitions now that we had been in before, but never as deeply, never as strongly because of him. So the NAACP is not your father's NAACP today.
Much more broad. And what they want to challenge.
It's part of a movement that's much broader than the older movement we were in.
And you mentioned the issue of same-sex marriage within the NAACP and the support that you found for it. But I wonder, do you have any thoughts on, because it seems to be a continuous problem within Black communities and with the NAACP, I'm thinking both kind of specifically in previous elections, And what are your thoughts on whether the issue of gay and lesbian rights will become more of an accepted issue abroad in civil rights beyond?
Oh, I certainly think so. I think you can see that already. Mm-hmm. Look at the Cheney family. I mean, would you have thought that Dick Cheney himself would be a supporter of same-sex marriage? He appears to be.
Right.
And at least one of his daughters is, because she's in one.
Right.
And the other daughter is doing it only because she's running for office. I'm positive that's why she's doing it, which doesn't speak well for her. But anyway, I think this idea that gay people have the same rights as everybody else is moving forward so quickly. Mm. I would not have believed it happened. I mean, just like a gunshot going through the air.
Right.
And I put that down to television, having gay characters and sympathetic gay characters, and to more and more gay people saying, listen, I'm gay, you know me, you've been working next to me for 10 years and you knew I was gay all along, and I want you to know I'm gay right now. Mm-hmm. Because more and more gay people have had the bravery to say I'm gay and I'm proud of it. Mm-hmm. So I think all these things together just push this issue forward and are going to keep pushing it forward until it becomes an ordinary thing.
Right. Well, I mentioned North Carolina, and I'm curious to know your thoughts on, I imagine you may have heard of the Moral Mondays protests.
Yes, sure, very much.
So what is your thought on the North Carolina legislature and then the Moral Mondays response?
Well, I'm going to say tonight that, you know, when I was in the Georgia legislature, we had a saying, thank God for Mississippi, because we were always better than Mississippi. But now the other 49 states are saying, thank God for North Carolina, because North Carolina has given them something to be better than. And it's just a pathetic. Somebody sent me an email this afternoon, an hour or so ago, said that when he was young, people used to say Florida, this guy lives in Florida, said Florida is just Mississippi with money. And I'm trying to think of something I could turn around and say, North Carolina is Mississippi with PhDs, or something like that. So I need to write that down. It's Reverend Barber. He's just such a marvelous organizer and a guy who can see the big picture and explain the big picture. And it's just, you know, I wish the NAACP had dozens more like him. We do have other state conference presidents who are as vigorous, as outspoken, as clever as he is, but not many. I wish we had dozens more.
Mm-hmm. Of course, one of the central issues with the legislature and the Moral Mondays response has been this issue of voter ID laws. And I'm wondering what you think of the current national debate on voter ID and the legality and the history of that.
Well, I'm very proud of the work that the Department of Justice has done, mm-hmm, in trying to fight back against these laws. I hope they're successful. I'm not sure they're going to be in every case. I think they're going to lose in some of these cases. But nonetheless, I think over the long run, the good side is going to prevail, and we'll not have the same kind of hobbling of voters that we had in past years, because this is just an attempt to return to the old Jim Crow Dixie ideas of limiting the way black people can vote. That's all it is. Mm-hmm. It's nothing more than that. But I think we'll overcome that. Mm-hmm. Maybe not entirely, but we'll overcome it. Mm-hmm. I'm an optimist. I always believe the best thing's going to happen.
Right.
And it usually does. Mm-hmm.
Well, just seeing the response of Moral Mondays, I think, is a cause for optimism and the kind of...
I think so. If you can just keep some backbone in the Democrats, that's a big question. Is that going to happen? And if it does, we'll come out okay.
Mm-hmm. So, with thinking about broad civil rights issues, do you think that the civil rights movement ended at some point, or is it still ongoing?
I think it's still ongoing. I mean, the Moral Mondays is part of it, and it would be happening in every state if you had leadership like Reverend Barber. And unfortunately, you don't have that everywhere, but you have it in some places, and other people are going to say, you know, see what they're doing in North Carolina. We can do that here, and we will do it. Mm-hmm. So, I'm an optimist. I think that the good things are going to happen.
That brings me to the end of my questioning. Is there anything that I brought up or you wanted to elaborate more on or anything such
no,
as that?
No, I'll think of something when I leave and it'll be too late then.
Okay. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Could I ask a follow-up question?
Sure.
Sure.
You had mentioned the need to complicate and fill out the public perception of the civil rights movement, and that the players were more than Dr. King, that there were ordinary people on the ground. Could you speak briefly to the role of women in the movement, whether they were grassroots organizers or women who had much broader public presence, either way?
I was just looking at a book, which you probably know about, Hands on the Freedom Plow, 52 Women Who Worked for SNCC. This is a collection of essays by 52 women who worked for SNCC, telling how they got into SNCC and what they did. And it's just a remarkable book because I knew almost all of these women and I didn't know some of these things about them. I didn't know their background. I didn't know what their parents did. I didn't know anything about that. I knew them. That was it. And I knew them in the SNCC context, but no other. And it's just wonderful how these varied people, and they're so different. They're so different each from the other, came together and helped make this organization what it was. And then you think about the older women, people like Ella Baker, who played such a role in the movement and who literally is almost unknown today. That's peculiar. You know, there have been at least four books written about her, four good books written about her, but she's still not well known. And Fannie Lou Hamer, two or three books about Mrs. Hamer, she's not well known. And the list goes on and on and on and on and on. And I don't know how you get these people to be better known than they are. Obviously, writing books doesn't do it alone, but somehow or the other, maybe movies. That's a good idea. Make a movie. But you don't get a complete story of the movement unless you know a wider scope of the participants. And we don't have a wider scope of the participants. You know, historians have begun to include this wider scope. The books that are being written now and come out now. Just a new book about the March on Washington by, what's this guy's name?
William Jones?
Yeah, William Jones. Shows you these women who are in the Union. I didn't know anything about them. It's an incredible story to read about these women. So I guess we have to write more books, tell more stories, have to do something because we need to tell these stories.
If there are no other thoughts or anything else, we'll just thank you and turn everything off.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Moyer.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. As the Speaker of the House of Representatives used to say in Georgia, the time for convening having arrived, all members will please take your seats and cease all conversation.
Very official.
Thank you.